Chapter 9, Law and Order, Crime and Criminal Behavior.
The power of expediency and the desire to get something for nothing is nowhere more obvious than in criminal behavior aimed at theft, fraud, embezzlement, or violence of some kind. As Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The darkest day of a man's life is when he begins thinking about how he can get something to which he is not entitled." Richard Dawkins, the geneticist, in his book The Selfish Gene, theorized that everyone is genetically programmed to be selfish in assuring their personal survival success and procreation. Many experts suggest that people also have a criminal gene that predisposes them to engage in dishonest behaviors, or as we would put it, to attempt to get something for nothing. This theory says that almost everyone has the propensity to steal under the right circumstances. How many times have you heard the question, "What would you do if you were certain that you could get away with it?" We know now that this is the something-for-nothing impulse, driven by the E factor, the fact that each person is lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient. This criminal gene is the manifestation of the desire of each person to acquire safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment the fastest and easiest way possible. It is rooted deep in human nature. Only a person with character, someone possessed of honesty and integrity, which he or she will not compromise under any circumstances, can rise above and control this genetic predisposition. For too many others, the intense desire to get something for nothing impels them to rationalize and justify behaviors that they know are antisocial and unacceptable. This is why they conduct them out of sight of others whenever possible, and deny that they have committed these crimes even when they are caught red-handed and in the presence of witnesses. There's an old saying, "You can't cheat an honest man." Every swindle and scam is aimed at people who could be tempted into believing that they can get back more than they put in, that they can get riches without working, that somehow, if everything goes just right, they can get something for nothing. The newspapers report stories every week of people who have lost their savings to crooks who have promised them huge returns on their money and then absconded with the funds. People seeking easy money are these criminals' favorite prey. The fact is that there is no easy money. There is no way to get something for nothing. Get-rich-quick schemes only work for the perpetrator, not the victim. It's been said that there's a sucker born every minute and a con man born every 59 seconds to take advantage of him. Some time ago, a habitual criminal was released after serving most of his adult life in prison. When he was asked why he turned to a life of crime, he said, "I did it for the easy money." The reporter asked, "After all these years in prison, how do you feel about it now?" The criminal replied ruefully, "Easy money was the hardest money I ever got." It takes many years of hard work and experience to achieve success in any field. It takes many years of saving and investing to accumulate a financial estate. Most people do not start earning serious money until after the age of 45. It takes that many years to build up the reservoir of knowledge and experience that makes it possible for him to earn a substantial income. The average age of self-made millionaires in America is 57, and it takes approximately 22 years of hard work to get there. Mastery in any field leading to high income takes 7 years on average and 10,000 hours of hard work. There are no shortcuts. If anyone gets money quickly and easily, this money has to come from others who have acquired it slowly and painstakingly. The money has to be earned by someone before it can be stolen by someone else. On the sliding scale of character that I described earlier, from 10 high to 1 low, the propensity to engage in criminal behavior increases as a person moves down the scale of character. People at the bottom of the character scale will steal at the first opportunity, almost reflexively. In society, to protect against this type of person with this criminal instinct, there must always be a police power authorized to use force to stop criminal acts and a court system to punish them when they take place. Civil society is only possible within a framework of law, order, and respect for individuals and property, and a general commitment to the common good. Because of the criminal gene and the desire to get something for nothing, eternal vigilance is necessary. Sadly enough, there are people who have little or no respect for law and order, or for individuals and property, and who do not particularly care about the common good of their fellow citizens. The only way to stop this type of person from engaging in criminal behavior is to arrest and incarcerate him. Whenever there is no immediate threat of capture and punishment, criminal behavior happens spontaneously and automatically. The propensity to engage in theft and violence lies just beneath the surface in many people. It can be quickly activated by an opportunity to commit a crime and get away with it. After the Rodney King trial in Simi Valley, in which the police were acquitted of brutality, people gathered in crowds in the low-income neighborhood of South Central Los Angeles. Believing that the presence of the police might trigger negative reactions from the crowds, Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates decided to withdraw all police from the area. 2 minutes after this withdrawal was announced on the radio, the first window was broken and the full-fledged South Central riots and looting began. For 3 days, South Central Los Angeles was in chaos, with buildings on fires and looters by the hundreds breaking into every store, carrying off food, furniture, television sets, and clothes. Reporters from the major networks ventured in to cover the riots. When they asked rioters if they were looting because of their anger at the Rodney King verdict, fully 75% of the looters didn't know anything about it. "Why are you rioting and looting?" the reporters asked. One looter replied to the television cameraman, speaking for the majority of the looters. He said, "Are you crazy? They ain't no cops." 3 days later, the police were sent back into South Central Los Angeles. The looting stopped immediately. The riots ended. They never started up again. In cities all over the U.S., crowds gathered to hear the Rodney King verdict. But the police never left those neighborhoods, and there was no rioting or looting anywhere except in Los Angeles. The point is that you can have all the crime you want in any society by just not punishing lawbreakers, or by not punishing them quickly and visibly. You can reduce or even eliminate crime by making punishment swift and sure. The something-for-nothing gene that lies just below the surface will explode into thievery and violence of all kinds as soon as the likelihood of punishment declines or disappears. It's true that criminal acts may be triggered or exacerbated by poverty, drugs, alcohol, mental instability, external influences, and many other factors. These factors may be necessary, but they are not sufficient. Just because they exist does not mean that the person will commit a crime. Most poor people are honest. Criminals in general, like most people, behave rationally in that they seek rewards versus punishment, success versus failure, easily gotten goods versus hard-earned success. This is the same even with better-educated white-collar criminals. In other words, criminal behavior involves a choice on the part of the criminal. This decision to commit a crime, like all occurrences, is subject to the law of probabilities. This law says that there is a probability that any given event will occur. Human beings, including criminals, are rational and calculating. They are lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient. They strive to get the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment they want in the fastest and easiest and safest way possible. They commit crimes because stealing appears to be the very best way to achieve their goals, all things considered. According to criminologists and based on interviews with convicted felons, there are four areas of probability that a criminal considers, consciously or unconsciously, before engaging in a criminal act. The first question the criminal asks is, "Will I get caught? What are the probabilities?" The fact is that criminals fear arrest and incarceration more than anything else. If the probability of being caught is increased or decreased, the propensity for someone who is criminally inclined to commit a criminal act decreases or increases accordingly. The second question a criminal considers is, "If I am caught, will I be convicted and incarcerated?" If the probability of being caught is reasonably high, and the probability of a stiff jail sentence, like a three-strike sentence, is high, criminal activities decrease. The odds are no good. In fact, once three strikes was passed in California, so many career criminals moved out of the state that California was accused of exporting its crime problem. If criminals are let off on probation more than once, they become even more likely to engage in criminal acts. The fear of incarceration, which serves as a deterrent to criminal behavior, loses its effectiveness. The third question the criminal considers is, "If I get caught, arrested, and convicted, how much time am I likely to serve in jail or prison?" Because of the E factor, short sentences actually increase the propensity to engage in criminal activity. They actually increase the demand for criminal acts by inducing criminals to provide the supply. According to Professor Joanna M. Shepherd of Clemson University, truth in sentencing laws, which require violent felons to serve up to 85% of their sentences, reduced violent crime rates. These laws reduced murder rates per 100,000 residents by 1.2 incidents. They reduced assaults by 44.8 incidents per 100,000 residents, and robberies by 39.6 incidents. Rapes and larcenies also declined significantly. A society that does not punish its criminals creates a market demand for more crime, not only by the individual criminal himself, but by everyone he tells about how little time he served, if he served any time at all. The fourth question each criminal considers is, how much am I likely to steal and get away with in comparison with the amount of time I am likely to serve if caught? The potential criminal then considers how long he would have to work to earn the same amount of money that he could get by stealing. If the amount of money he could get by stealing represents many months or even years of hard work, and the likelihood of getting caught, arrested, and convicted is low, the structure of incentives favors engaging in criminal behavior. According to Professor Stephen Levitt of the University of Chicago, for each prisoner released from prison, there was an increase of 17 reported and unreported crimes per year. Every commuted death sentence was correlated with an increase of 5 murders. On the other hand, for each execution, on average, 18 fewer murders occurred. All these considerations blend into a simple question. Do I commit the crime or not? This final decision will be the sum total result of the probabilities of the first 4 questions. This is easily provable by the experience of cities that post uniform police officers in high crime areas. The incidence of crime drops immediately. One element that exacerbates this temptation to engage in criminal behavior is criminal defense lawyers. These people are also driven by the E factor, seeking the fastest and easiest ways to get the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment they want. The fastest and easiest way to achieve their personal and financial goals is to get their clients off at all costs. Most criminals have little money. They usually have to get out on bail so that they can steal enough to pay their legal bills, and criminal defense lawyers know this. Repeat criminals have repeat needs for criminal lawyers. Every criminal lawyer knows that a criminal in jail is not a good source of income or billable hours. This is why criminal lawyers use every trick and technique possible to get their clients back on the street as soon as possible. We must accept that for some people at the lower end of the scale of character, criminal behavior is an immediate reflex to a criminal opportunity. This is why, throughout history, the only way to reduce criminality is by swift and sure punishment combined with longer prison sentences. Throughout the 20th century up to the 1960s, all forms of recorded crime in the U.S. decreased year by year. In 1960, the murder rate, for example, was just half of what it had been in 1934. During this period, policing was fast and efficient. Criminals were usually caught and arrested quickly and imprisoned with lengthy sentences. This rapid arrest and incarceration dramatically decreased the propensity of people on the margin to engage in criminal activities. In the 1950s, the country was so safe that it was common for people to leave their keys in their cars and leave their homes unlocked when they went to work. In the 1960s, with the baby boom generation pouring out of the universities full of compassion and idealism, a new way of viewing criminals became popular. Instead of seeing them as dangerous to themselves and society, they were viewed as innocent victims of poverty and other social conditions. The Miranda Act gave more rights to criminals than ever before. Instead of catching a criminal and getting a quick confession, police were required to read the arrested person his rights. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to a lawyer. If you cannot afford one, a lawyer will be provided to you. Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. Now, this may have been justified by overly aggressive police work in some cases, but what it did was to give the arrested criminal ample time and opportunity to compose his story and deny guilt. This led to crowded courts, plea bargaining, release on bail, probation, and suspended sentences. As it became less likely that a person would be caught, convicted, and incarcerated, the crime rate began to increase. Meanwhile, the length of jail sentences and even the probabilities of conviction declined. Many judges took great delight in throwing cases of obviously guilty criminals out of court on minor technicalities, such as
a misspelling of the middle initial on the arrest report. Predictably, crime rates rose continually throughout the 70s and 80s. Between 1960 and 1980, the national violent crime rate increased by 360%. The national murder rate doubled. The number of forcible rapes increased 380%. The number of robberies was up 420%. The aggravated assault rate increased 350%. The property crimes rate, the burglary rate, and larceny theft rate all jumped over 300%. America found itself experiencing a crime wave. People began saying that the criminal is back on the street before the victim is out of the hospital. Finally, in the 1980s, the tide began to turn. Arrests and convictions increased. Mandatory prison sentences took the discretionary power of sentencing away from liberal judges who were releasing criminals on minor technicalities. California passed its three strikes law, giving a three-time criminal a life sentence without parole. This law was a reaction by voters to a criminal justice system that was enabling criminals to terrorize the population and even win lawsuits against the victims who fought back. As you can imagine, based on the E factor, the biggest foes of three-strike laws and stiffer sentencing were the criminal lawyers, who were losing their paying customers one by one, and the politicians that they were supporting. The cruelest thing you can do to a person who is on the mental verge of criminality is to tempt him to break the law by suggesting that he can get away with it. The perverse effect of coddling criminals, especially juveniles, by granting probation, reducing sentences, and allowing parole too early is to encourage people of weak character with little self-discipline or self-control to embrace a life of crime. There is no better and more important place, based on the ABC formula of human behavior discussed earlier, for tough love than when dealing with criminals, especially young criminals. The primary consideration of law enforcement at all levels must be to protect law-abiding citizens. A society can have as much or as little crime as it wants just by increasing or decreasing the probabilities of punishment. Unfortunately, people who deliberately set out to rob, cheat, defraud, assault, rape, or murder innocent people understand no other reasoning than rapid and effective law enforcement. Swift and sure punishment is the only way to control the rate of crime. It is the kindest way to organize society for the criminally inclined, but especially for law-abiding men and women. Most crimes in our society are committed by fewer than 5% of the criminals. According to a Justice Department study of state prisoners released in 1994, 2/3 were rearrested within 3 years. In the meantime, these offenders had generated over 744,000 arrests, including 2,871 arrests for murder, 2,363 arrests for kidnapping, 2,444 arrests for rape, 3,151 arrests for other sexual assaults, 21,245 arrests for robbery, and 54,604 arrests for assault. Prior to their imprisonment, these prisoners accounted for 4.1 million arrests, including 550,000 violent crime arrests. The highest rearrest rates were for robbers, 70.2%, burglars, 74%, larcenists, 74.6%, and motor vehicle thieves, 78.8%. These are the hardcore criminals who are not capable of restraining themselves from engaging in criminal activities. They have fallen so far down the scale of character and human decency that they are virtually impossible to save. The only thing that can be done with them is to put them away for long periods of time, ideally beyond the criminal-prone ages of 15 to 40. Sometimes, considering the nature of the crimes, the very best thing that a society can do is to incarcerate them for life without parole. The solution to criminal activity is to continually raise the cost of committing a crime until most criminal behavior is discouraged. It is to increase the likelihood of capture and long periods of incarceration until it makes no sense to the criminally inclined to risk such onerous punishment for such an unsure reward. Organize the structure of incentives based on the E factor so that it makes more sense for more people to work for what they get and to become productive members of society. Chapter 10, Welfare, Entitlements, and Society.
How did people ever get the idea that they could live off the hard work and sweat of others? And even worse, come to believe that they were entitled to take the food off of someone else's table to put on their own. Welfare and all other forms of unearned, undeserved free money stimulates and encourages the worst aspects of the E-factor, driving more and more people towards seeking something for nothing. Free money destroys character and confidence, undermines self-worth, robs people of their dignity, and makes them feel like victims having no control of their lives. And no matter how much free money they get, it is never enough. For all the years of human history, up until about 1900, there was a direct, visible, and accepted link between sowing and reaping, between putting in and getting out. In the last 100 years, throughout the industrialized countries, this link has been severed. Clever and complex government accounting procedures are now used to mask the fact that people are getting something for nothing to the detriment of everyone involved. Opportunistic politicians, motivated to get votes by offering free money to more and more people with fewer strings attached and fewer requirements, have driven the most powerful and prosperous countries in the world into technical bankruptcy. According to economists, the total value of all land and property in the United States in 2005 is about $48 trillion. However, the unfunded liabilities of Social Security, Medicare, AFDC, government pensions, and 1,000 other government entitlement programs amount to over $72 trillion. If the U.S. was a company, it would be declared insolvent and put into liquidation. Using the numbers generated by Lawrence J. Kotlikoff in his work on intergenerational accounting, it is estimated that a child born today will be paying 76% to 84% of his or her income in taxes as an adult just to fund the entitlements on the books today. This assumes that there will be no more entitlement programs passed for the next 50 years. The latest Medicare program alone will cost more than $7 trillion that will have to come out of our taxes and taxes on our children. For 75 years, since the 1930s, politicians of all types have been practicing après moi le déluge, after me the flood, approach to political spending. The Social Security program passed in 1934 was actually a thinly disguised way of increasing taxes during the Depression. At that time, the life expectancy of Americans was 62 years, so the politicians set the age of retirement at 65 years. Thinking that they would never have to pay it out, they then spent every single penny collected every single year up to the present day. With the 70 million strong baby boomer generation retiring and a life expectancy of 79 years and growing, there are now at least $17 trillion of unfunded liabilities in Social Security. Where is this money going to come from? The politicians of both parties have voted year after year to give increased amounts of money to more and more identifiable voting blocks, knowing that these amounts would eventually overwhelm the ability of the U.S. economy to pay them. But they weren't concerned. These politicians, with their incredibly generous pension and medical programs tied to inflation, would be out of office and retired long before the chickens came home to roost. Trillions of dollars of debt have been heaped onto the shoulders of our children and grandchildren in exchange for current consumption for the current generation. These amounts can never be repaid. Where did people ever get the idea that they could spend money that they did not earn? How did people come to believe that they could reap without sowing, that they could consume without producing, that they could live off the hard work and sweat of others? When and how did so many people come to believe that they were not responsible for themselves, for their lives, and for their own futures? People are neither good nor bad as a rule. They are merely expedient. They are lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient. They continually seek to get more and more of the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment they desire. Whenever the prospect of free money, of something for nothing, raises its ugly head, the ability of the average person to resist first weakens and then collapses. Free money quickly becomes an addiction, as bad as any narcotic, distorting the senses, perverting values, weakening the recipient, turning him into an obsessed person who must have more and more. No amount is ever enough. Like a drug addict, the recipient of free money needs more and more of it in order to be satisfied. If the additional supply of free money is not forthcoming, they demand it,
lobby for it, protest for it, and march for it. Any suggestion that their free money might be cut off can trigger demonstrations and riots. Politicians are entrepreneurial in this area of dispensing free money. Because they are eager to get the votes of these people who want more free money, they demand even more on their behalf. Of course, they mask their demands with dishonest appeals to compassion and need, but the real reason, as opposed to the reason that sounds good, is that they hope to use these voters to get back into office at the next election. If ever there's a suggestion that the flow of free money might be reduced or curtailed, cries of anguish and threats of disaster fill the air. But for some amazing reason, these potential tragedies never seem to occur. People, being expedient, always find a way to get by. When Congress passed the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, the hysterical politicians who had been riding on the backs of the poor into office year after year predicted widespread homelessness and 1 million children starving. 3 years later, even the most skeptical observers had to admit that the level of homelessness has actually dropped and that no child had missed a meal because of welfare reform. After 1996, the employment rate of disadvantaged single mothers increased 50 to 100%. By 2004, there were 2.3 million fewer children in poverty than there were in 1996. The poverty rates of both black children and children of single mothers have been cut by one-third and are now at the lowest point in U.S. history. Recipients of free money soon develop elaborate excuses and justifications for why they are entitled to it. They claim that they are unfortunate, that they are victims, that they have been shortchanged by society. Society owes them this money as compensation for what society has done to them or not done for them. Simultaneously, the recipients of free money attack and demonize not only the sources of their free money, working people paying taxes, but anyone who questions the appropriateness of giving them even more. They are called mean or stingy, or the favorite epithet of all, racist. Free money is destructive. Once a person begins to receive it on a regular basis, his self-respect, self-esteem, dignity, and self-reliance go down the drain. He becomes weak and grasping. He loses all sense of personal pride and independence. People addicted to welfare and entitlements soon become desperate to hold on to them. As we said before, the fear of loss or withdrawal generates 2.5 times the negative emotions of fear and anger as the idea of getting the money in the first place. The fastest way to get people into the streets demonstrating is to tell them that those people are going to cut back or eliminate your free money. The scariest thing you can say to a senior citizen to get them to vote for you is that those other people are going to take away your Social Security. People who are living off the sweat of others and who know in their hearts that they make no contribution to the society they live in soon become angry, hostile, and mean-spirited. With too much time on their hands and no work to do, they soon become easy prey for alcohol, drugs, petty crime, and other destructive behaviors that are common in the inner cities. Imagine that there was an evil person with incredible power who hated poor people. Imagine that this evil, demented person wanted to punish poor people in the worst way possible. What would he do? Assume that he is evil beyond comprehension. He hates poor people so much that he wants to destroy them financially, mentally, and emotionally, not just in the short term, but for their entire lives, if possible, and into the next generations of their families. What would be his best strategy? The answer is simple. Install a massive entitlement and welfare system and get as many people addicted to it as possible. Poor people, people at the lower end of the income scale, tend to be the most susceptible to the blandishments of free money. They often find it irresistible. They cannot stop themselves from reaching for it whenever it is offered. If you want to really hurt these people, you make them dependent on nameless, faceless, and usually uncaring bureaucrats for their very existence. Force them to line up, fill out forms, and bare their souls in order to get their applications for free money approved. In this way, you rob them of their pride and dignity, disgrace them before their family and friends, and make them feel useless and incompetent. Then, if you really hate them, you make their children dependent as well, and even pass laws making it illegal for unmarried mothers to live with the fathers of their children. Jesus said, "The poor you will have always with you." For most of human history, everyone was poor. Until the 19th century, the word poverty was seldom used. It was generally assumed that the great masses were poor and that only a few people at the top were well off. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution and the rapid improvements in living standards from 1815 onward, people became financially self-sufficient and even wealthy at the fastest rate in all of human history. For the first time, the poor actually became noticeable in contrast to the growing affluence of the population at large. It was at this time, in the wealthier societies, that doing something about the poor became affordable for the first time in history. There is within the heart of every normal person the desire to help those who are less fortunate. In every society, and at every level of society, people are motivated to lend a helping hand to the people around them who need it. This is a universal human trait. In his important book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith, later to write The Wealth of Nations, explained that the three primary motivations of the normal person are prudence, justice, and benevolence. Prudence was defined as the act of providing for oneself and one's family in the very best way possible. Justice meant supporting a legal and social system that protected one's life and property from the criminal behaviors of others. Once the needs of prudence and justice have been satisfied, every person turns normally and naturally toward benevolence, toward helping those who are in need of help. When some politicians beat their breasts and claim loudly that they care about people, while their opponents do not, they are engaging in falsehood and deception at the lowest level. The fact is that everyone cares about others, starting in the family and expanding outward into society. The only difference between people and parties is the question, what is the best way to help people, both in the short term and in the long term? People who think short term with little concern for the secondary consequences of their actions believe that the natural urges toward benevolence are best served by taking money away from people who have earned it and giving it immediately to people who need it at the moment, whether or not this robs them of their self-esteem and makes them dependent on government in the long term. People who think long term, on the other hand, people who think about the secondary consequences of their actions, believe that the best welfare program is a good job. They believe that the best citizen is a proud, independent, self-reliant person who is in control of his own life. People who think long-term do everything possible to encourage a vibrant business system that creates jobs, growth, hope, and opportunity for more people. Short-term thinkers, grasping for easy votes by offering free money, are continually at war with the long-term thinkers who believe that the creation and maintenance of a prosperous society is the best way to provide for the greatest number of people. In the 1800s, hundreds of voluntary groups motivated by the spirit of benevolence came together to set up what were called poor societies. These associations were organized by individuals and churches, staffed by volunteers, to work with the poor and unfortunate in cities and towns across the country. Their goals were to help people in difficulty get back on their feet and become active and productive members of society. In return for this assistance, the recipients of this help from these voluntary associations were required to abstain from drinking, to reconcile with their families whenever possible, to get cleaned up, learn new skills if necessary, and get paying jobs. In exchange, the poor societies helped them and supported them until they were back on their feet. They channeled the E factor in the most positive and productive way. As a result, the success rate with this system of self-help was phenomenal. Today, the Mormon Church has a similar system for church members who have fallen on hard times. But it is not charity. Even if the needy person is in a hospital bed, he is expected to make phone calls or address envelopes. His self-respect is kept intact. The goal of the Mormon Church is a whole person, back in society, making a contribution, a difference, as soon as possible. And each recipient of help from the church understands that at any time, he can be called upon to offer assistance to someone else. One hand continually washes the other, and as a result, there are no permanent welfare cases within the Mormon religion. In his book, The Tragedy of American Compassion, Arthur Marvin Olasky describes the evolution of American charity. He showed that when the government began offering welfare benefits at the beginning of the 20th century, the first thing they did was to cut away and eventually eliminate any of the strings that had been attached by private charities to this help. People being weak,
propelled by the E-factor, following the line of least resistance, seeking something for nothing whenever possible, soon abandoned the private charities and moved on to public assistance. It became even worse over time. The bureaucrats and government workers in the growing welfare bureaucracy were rewarded and promoted on the basis of numbers. How many people could they get onto the welfare rolls, and how much could they spend on these people? Being expedient, clever government officials and department heads, aided by opportunistic politicians, lobbied and agitated for ever more welfare programs and government assistance to be made available to ever larger groups with fewer and fewer requirements or restrictions. To keep up their numbers, one by one, the social service bureaucrats passed regulations to hold on to their welfare recipients once they had them dependent on the public purse. According to welfare regulations, a single mother living on welfare was forbidden to marry or even spend the night with the father of her illegitimate child. The welfare departments created welfare police who skulk around at night, attempting to catch a father sneaking in to spend time with the mother of his child. If he was caught, they threatened to throw the woman off welfare. If a welfare recipient attempted to get a job or to supplement his or her income, the welfare bureaucrats slashed the benefits she was receiving so dramatically that they were able to discourage any attempt to achieve self-sufficiency. Welfare recipients were not allowed to acquire property if they wanted to continue receiving the full range of benefits. If they had any money or property, they had to get rid of it as quickly as possible or be cut off from their free money. The system became completely dysfunctional, wreaking harm and havoc on everybody who was involved in it. The people who head up the state and federal welfare bureaucracies are usually college-educated, middle-class people who are well-paid. Many senior welfare bureaucrats earn more than $100,000 per year to preside over the administration of welfare programs. They work in nice offices, live in nice neighborhoods, and drive recent model automobiles. Most of them have never met a poor person. It gets even worse. Very often, both husbands and wives work within the welfare bureaucracy, as well as in other government departments. Jointly, they earn $150,000 to $200,000 per year or more and are officially classified as rich if you listen to certain politicians. After 30 years in the bureaucracy, they can retire with fully vested pensions, often at the age of 50. They then move sideways to the next department, start at a new job paying them what they were earning at their old job, and build up a second pension plan. This is the double dipping I described earlier, and it's extremely popular in government today. These people have become members of the new elite and live better than many doctors, lawyers, entrepreneurs, and other hard-working, highly educated professionals. They never deal face-to-face with welfare recipients. They're too well-paid and important for that. All up and down the line in the welfare bureaucracy, the E factor is at work. At every level, the six P's, pay, promotion, position, power, perks, and pensions, are tied into ever higher levels of funding. This requires ever more recipients of welfare programs receiving ever greater amounts for doing nothing. Until the welfare reforms of 1996, which were bitterly opposed as obscene and cruel, the system was out of control. Third and fourth generations of welfare families were too common. Many children had grown up, had children and grandchildren, and never held a job in their lives. The inner cities around them collapsed into crime, violence, drug dealing, and dysfunction. Since 1996, welfare caseloads have dropped 50%. Most welfare recipients, when they realized that the free money was going to be cut off, went out and got jobs. Today, those former welfare recipients are proud, contributing members of society. They are happy and respected members of their communities. They have broken the habit, and they feel proud of themselves and their accomplishments. J.C. Watts, former congressman from Oklahoma, worked hard in Congress to bring about these welfare reforms. His opponents accused him of lacking compassion for wanting to cut back on welfare programs and get people back into the economy with real jobs. He replied to his accusers by saying, "The difference between you and I is that you define compassion by how many people you can make dependent on government. I define compassion by how many people we can make independent of government." The welfare mentality, the entitlement mindset, the desire to get something for nothing, is destructive in two major ways. First of all, it destroys the self-esteem, self-respect, and personal dignity of the recipient.
Second, it undermines the qualities of responsibility, self-reliance, and fairness upon which America is built. If someone consumes without producing, someone else must be forced to produce without consuming. The money he earns for himself and his family must be taken away from him in the form of taxation on his income to give to people who have made no effort to earn the money at all. Ultimately, all taxes come out of the paychecks and pockets of the working person. There is no other source of money. Being legally deprived of the money you have earned, to have it given to others who don't or won't work for it, makes a person feel cheated and angry. For this reason, each politician, before he recommends any expansion of the flow of free money to any group, must ask the question, what would happen if everybody did what I recommend for some? What would happen if everybody decided to go on welfare? What would happen if everyone decided that the best way to get the things they wanted was to manipulate the government to get something for nothing? As soon as you take any welfare policy recommendation to the extreme, to the possibility of everyone taking advantage of it, you see immediately that most government giveaway schemes depend for their existence on the assumption that most people won't apply for them. But this is no basis for sound government policy. Parents in general love their children. If you love your children, you want the very best for them. You want them to grow up proud and happy, confident and competent, capable of making a good life for themselves as adults. The fact is that whatever you want for your own children, you should want for all children. You should never encourage or condone any action or behavior for the children of other people that you would not want to have become a part of your family and happen to your children. Our duty as citizens is to uncover and uproot any scheme that destroys people's pride and dignity by getting them addicted to free money. Especially, it is our civic duty to assure the very best for all our children by not allowing any structure of incentives that undermines their hopes for the future. Your job is to recognize that the reason that sounds good is always based on compassion and generosity. But the real reason that any politician advocates any something-for-nothing free money policy is to buy votes with other people's money, either directly or indirectly, with little or no concern for the long-term consequences of these policies. Politicians and political policies that are short-sighted and expedient lie at the root of most of our social and economic problems today and have been responsible for the decline and fall of every great civilization in human history. Chapter 11, A Time for Truth. Most of our social, economic, and political problems are rooted in the desire to get something for nothing, multiplied in intensity by the twin emotions of envy and resentment. Just as the lowest common denominators of human nature are greed and laziness, the fastest and easiest way to justify an attempt to get something for nothing is to proclaim that those who have what you want do not deserve it, and you do. The tragedy is that it is impossible to build a coherent and healthy philosophy and worldview on negative emotions, especially the desire to take away from others what you have not earned. As soon as people begin to allow themselves to be guided by the destructive emotions of envy and resentment, they become incapable of honesty, integrity, and rational thought. There are two general ways of looking at the world. A person can have a benevolent worldview or a malevolent worldview. A person with a benevolent worldview looks at life and the world honestly and realistically, recognizing that there are many problems and deficiencies, but in the main it is a good place, and definitely preferable to the alternatives. This type of person tends to be optimistic about the future, looking for the good in people and situations, focusing on solutions rather than problems, and is generally positive, constructive, and hopeful. Everything good and worthwhile in society is created by those people who have a benevolent worldview. They are the movers and shakers, the leaders and guides, the excellent parents, the entrepreneurs, scientists, poets, and creators of all good things. They are the spirit of America. People with a malevolent worldview, on the other hand, are primarily negative and cynical in their outlooks. They look for the worst in people and situations. They are characterized by low self-esteem and low self-worth. They don't like themselves, and as a result, they don't like many others. They see problems everywhere. They see injustice, oppression, unfairness, and inequalities of income and status. No solution is ever enough. No situation is ever satisfactory. For these people, there is always something wrong. The person with a negative worldview must always have an enemy. Someone always has to be to blame for every problem affecting anyone, anywhere. Someone must be identified and punished. It requires effort, imagination, and discipline to remain positive during the inevitable ups and downs of daily life. But it takes no effort at all to become angry and resentful and to lash out at those who seem to be happier and more successful than you, or others whose situation you take personally. The tragedy is that the more a person gives in to anger or negativity of any kind, the easier and more automatic it becomes for him to become and stay angry in the future. Anger, resentment, and envy feed upon each other until they consume the person who harbors them. They are totally destructive emotions and lie at the root of many of our problems in society today. It is said that anger is an acid that corrodes the vessel that contains it. The central role of self-esteem and self-image, how much you like yourself and how you see yourself, cannot be overemphasized. They constitute the person you are inside. These core elements of your personality have overwhelming effects on your worldview. Each person has a deep inner need to feel important and valuable and to be respected by others. Each person needs to believe in something bigger than himself. As Viktor Frankl, founder of Logotherapy and author of the book Man's Search for Meaning, said, "The deepest need of human beings is for a sense of meaning and purpose in life." However, America is a meritocracy, the first genuine meritocracy established in history. In a meritocracy, you are inevitably rewarded for your own personal merit and for the value of the contribution you make to others. But because people are driven by the E factor, by the tendency to be lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient, many of them seek rewards and results without effort or contribution. This is exactly the opposite of effective behavior in a meritocracy. At the political level, there will always be opportunistic people who will offer to represent those who do not want to work for what they get. These opportunistic politicians will create elaborate arguments to prove why it is that these prospective voters should be given free money. As soon as the specter of free money, of something for nothing, or for very little, raises its ugly head, more and more people will attempt to get it. The decline and fall of the Roman Empire came about when the Romans lost their drive to colonize and increase the wealth of their people. The leaders instead began offering the increasingly demanding populace bread and circuses to distract them, quiet them, and buy their votes and support, at least temporarily. The welfare state of ancient Rome destroyed the empire from within, like a cancer, before the barbarians destroyed it from without, with armed power. The two great questions you have to ponder when considering any personal and government action are these. First, is it true for me? Is what you are saying or hearing true for you? Or do you think that it may be true for others, but not for yourself? Listen to your inner voice. Be perfectly honest with yourself. Trust your own instincts. Only accept the premise or promise that feels right and is consistent with your own personal knowledge and experience. Many of our most complex problems could be quickly resolved if each person were to ask themselves this question, is this true for me, when considering the arguments and claims of politicians and activists who are driven by the E factor to achieve their goals the fastest and easiest way possible. The second question you should ask is, what would happen if everyone did it? Many ideas for free money and something for nothing quickly fall apart when they're held up against the possibility of everyone engaging in a suggested behavior. They would be completely impossible. Let's examine some of the most emotionally divisive issues in our society today and see how they can be better understood in the light of the E factor, the desire to get something for nothing, and the natural tendency to follow the path of least resistance to acquire money and power and the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment that go with them. Let's talk first of all about number one, affirmative action and welfare. There are two ways to get the material rewards you desire in our society. You can earn them yourself through hard work, or you can find some way to get the government to force someone else to give them to you. Here is a simple question. Which is the easiest? The questions surrounding race are complex and emotional. There was slavery, injustice, prejudice, and oppression for much of American history. They still exist throughout much of the world today. In the 1960s, most of the legal barriers to full participation and equality were swept aside. Affirmative action laws were passed to help African Americans catch up. The war on poverty began under President Lyndon Johnson in 1964 with the unproven and now disproven idea that by giving people free money, they would soon become proud, productive members of society. Affirmative action was designed to achieve this, but to be both remedial and temporary. It failed disastrously, primarily because it tried to contradict the E factor. It tried to make water flow uphill. From 1940 to 1960, according to African-American economist Thomas Sowell, before the Civil Rights Movement, the poverty rate among black families dropped from 87% to 47%. The relative incomes of blacks in comparison to whites doubled between 1936 and 1959. Rates of teenage pregnancy and venereal disease declined year after year. By every measure, black Americans were moving upward in almost every area. Then, in the 1960s, came affirmative action and the war on poverty. Thomas Sowell has written, "The black family, which had endured centuries of slavery and discrimination, began rapidly disintegrating in the liberal welfare state that changed welfare from an emergency program to a way of life. Teenage pregnancies and illegitimate births increased to 65% of all black births. Violent crime, most of it black on black, soared. Urban riots increased. Welfare rates went through the roof. The something-for-nothing virus swept through the black community, destroying the hopes and dreams of a generation." Affirmative action and the quotas for hiring and advancement that flow from it today quickly become barely disguised attempts to confer something-for-nothing on special groups. If companies are forced by law and the threat of prosecution from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to hire unqualified minorities in proportion to their percentage of the local population, they will do it to avoid legal problems. But this short-term expedient does not develop talent, skill, or character in the beneficiary. It only serves to reinforce his perception of victimhood. The cruelest thing you can do to any person, and especially a member of a minority, is to stigmatize him as inferior for life by using the power of government to put him in a position that he has not earned and for which he is not qualified. Even if he has worked hard and is fully qualified for the position, because of affirmative action, he and others around him will always suspect that he was not good enough to get the job on his own merits. In higher education, there's ample evidence that affirmative action has hurt a large number of minority students who are admitted to universities for which they're not academically qualified. Because of the intense competition at these universities, they fare poorly, score lower grades, fall behind, and drop out at much higher rates than minority students who attend colleges with other students at their same grade level. The fact is that there's little racial prejudice remaining in America today. The word prejudice means to prejudge. It means to form an opinion or make an assessment of a person in advance based on preconceived ideas or generalities, not based on fact or experience. On this basis, most Americans are open, accepting, and non-judgmental of others before they get to know them and experience them firsthand. In fact, there's probably more reverse prejudice than anything else. More Americans are willing to make special efforts to open up doors and create opportunities for minorities than ever before. No laws mandating this behavior are necessary. People do it out of a genuine feeling of benevolence for their fellow man or woman. No quotas or affirmative action are necessary. In a free market society like the U.S., there is a continuous competition for talent and skill. Every business knows that the critical constraint on its ability to grow is competent people who can get results. Like cream rising to the top, people who can do a good job are hired sooner, paid more, and promoted faster. People who are not competent or motivated are not. No laws can change this. They can only mask it temporarily. Some of the most talented and respected people in sports, business, show business, and public life are from minority groups. They are admired, esteemed, and successful because they are talented, and they do what they do in an excellent fashion, and for no other reason. Think about people like Oprah, Tiger Woods, Bill Cosby, Michael Jordan, Morgan Fairchild, and Denzel Washington. In America, nobody really cares about your background. In a meritocracy, all people really care about is your competence and your character right now. And this is under your control. Compassion can quickly become condescension. Minority groups can become victims of what President George Bush called the soft bigotry of reduced expectations. People begin to judge them by lower standards and expect less of them in comparison with others. This is completely unacceptable in America. The way you bring the best out of people is by challenging them, by setting high standards, by demanding their best game. You help people by encouraging them to aspire to excellence and by treating them as if they have the potential to do more and be better than they ever have before. The way you help people is by controlling the structure of incentives, the B of the performance formula, and not by allowing them any other way to achieve their goals except by doing their best consistently and dependably. Let's talk about the second area of American society, knowledge and education. Knowledge and skill are the keys to opening the doors of the opportunity in the 21st century. The more you learn and the better you get, the more opportunities you will have, the more you will be paid, and the faster you will be promoted. In a free society, in the absence of government interference and coercion, there is no other way to get ahead. The purpose of early education is to prepare young people to enter the workforce as adults and become valuable, proud, productive members of society. The purpose of education is to enable young people to be free, independent, and capable of making a good living. The U.S. education system, once the best in the world and still the best at the university level, has become a tragedy and a trap for most young people caught up in it and unable to escape. In 1947, 97% of Americans were literate, reading several books each year and often each month. By 2004, fully 47% of Americans could not read above the 7th grade level. People who have not mastered the 3 R's by the time they leave school are destined to lifetimes of low income, underachievement, and wasted potential. In the watershed study by the National Committee on Excellence in Education in 1983 called A Nation at Risk, several governors of American states concluded that our educational system was in such bad shape that if a foreign nation had done to America what our education system is doing to our young people, it would be considered an act of war. If anything, the situation has gotten progressively worse over the years, especially for the most disadvantaged of our youth. Today, African American students test at 4 grade levels below white and Asian students in the same schools. Even worse, they are not allowed to escape their failing schools, especially in the inner cities. They are trapped into lifetimes of below average incomes, insecurity, and eventually, envy, resentment, and feelings of victimhood. The unleashing of the dogs of the E factor began when the first teachers' union was formed in the 1950s. In a few years, driven by expediency, the focus of teaching shifted from student achievement to teacher pay and benefits. As Albert Shanker, head of the American Teachers Federation, once said, "When the children start paying union dues, then we'll start caring about the children." Because of the structure of incentives in teaching, there is little motivation or reward for teaching or not teaching, much less teaching well. Once a teacher has tenure, he or she becomes almost impossible to discipline or fire. Teachers are paid solely on the basis of seniority, not quality. They receive the same pay whether they do a good job of teaching or not. Even after countless studies showing that there's no relation between class size and student achievement, the teachers' unions repeatedly call for more money for schools, higher pay for themselves, less work, smaller class sizes, and no performance standards at any time, at any level. The national resistance to the 2001 Bipartisan Act, No Child Left Behind, by the teachers' unions is a continuation of this resistance to standards of any kind. The teachers' unions, representing most of the teachers in America, provide millions of dollars and thousands of hours to elect politicians who promise to block any attempt at educational reform. Because of their numbers, they have become one of the most powerful forces in modern politics. The ultimate measure in the real world is results, but not in education. The end game in the teaching world is to process the students, educated or not, from one grade to the next until they finally leave school. Teachers are some of the highest-paid non-professionals in America, often earning $50,000, $60,000, and even $70,000 for a 9-month year that is crammed with days off, vacations, and teachers' conferences. The Economist magazine wrote on July 11, 2005, "The schools the poorest Americans attend have been getting worse rather than better. This is a problem of resources, to be sure, but it is even more a problem of bad ideas. The American educational establishment's weakness for airy-fairy notions about the evils of standards and competition is particularly damaging to poor children who have few educational resources of their own to fall back on. One poll of 900 professors of education, for example, found that 64% of them thought that schools should avoid competition. The only way to reverse the pernicious effects of the E-factor in education is to change the structure of incentives in such a way that academic excellence is pursued and rewarded. Without competition, there is no motivation to improve. Without competition, all the worst expressions of the E-factor are encouraged. The most important and impactful policy change in education would be school choice, allowing students and parents to choose their schools rather than being forced to stay in a school where the child is not learning. School choice and the voucher system in the pursuit of academic excellence was first proposed by Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize-winning economist, in the 1960s. The idea is simple. The United States spends an average of about $9,000 per student per year in the K-12 system, almost equivalent to private school tuition. With a voucher system, each parent would receive a voucher for each child of school age that could be spent at any school, public, private, or parochial, that the parent chose. The money would follow the student, not just go automatically to the school. Against extraordinary opposition by the teachers' unions, this system was introduced by African-American legislator Polly Williams and Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson to the Milwaukee school system some years ago. It was so successful in increasing competition in school grades that it spread to more schools and additional states. In 2002, the Supreme Court decided that school choice was legal under the Constitution. In 2005, Cleveland expanded its school choice program and approved 14,000 more vouchers to enable students to escape from failing schools. In addition to vouchers and school choice, principals must be allowed to fire poor teachers, which is not possible today, and to make everyone accountable. Without competition and standards, education in public schools deteriorates, leaving entire generations of poor students unable to read, write, and participate in the American dream as adults. The fact is that no matter how pleasant they appear on the outside, teachers, like everyone else, are lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient. They all want safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment. To achieve these ends, they strive for more power and money, and no amount is ever enough. It's generally assumed in public education that the 80-20 rule applies. 20% of the students will do well, no matter how good or bad the teaching or the school. 80% will do poorly. This is why they say that the private schools produce the leaders and managers while the public schools produce the workers. Nationwide, 21.5% of public school teachers have their children in private schools. This is outrageous. The only cure for the educational system, the only way to assure that every child gets an education that prepares them to be able to realize the American dream, is to introduce competition for academic excellence at all levels of the school system, both private and public. Whenever competition has been tried, academic accomplishment and grade levels increase immediately. Wherever there is no competition, children are educationally shortchanged. They never reach their full potential. They are put out into the workforce without the ability to provide for themselves and create the kind of lives they desire for themselves and their families. Now let's look at the third area of problems in America, immigration, legal and illegal. Immigration can be either a blessing or a curse, depending on three things. First, is it legal or illegal? The United States accepts more than 1 million legal immigrants each year, more than all the other countries in the world put together. If someone comes here legally, they have usually been carefully vetted through the proper political process and are much more likely to become valuable contributing members of American society. If the immigrant is illegal, this means that the first act of this person in coming to America is to break the law. If his or her first American experience is that of lawbreaking and getting away with it, the seeds are sown for further lawbreaking later on. This is why our prisons are jammed with thousands of illegal immigrants who have committed crimes against people and property, including mass murder. They arrived as criminals and then continued their lives of crime. Second, is the immigrant qualified and skilled or unqualified and unskilled? If the immigrant is capable of making a valuable contribution to society by participating in the process of producing goods and services that customers want, he can make a good life for himself while being a benefit to his community. If the immigrant is uneducated and unskilled, his ability to become a valuable member of society is diminished, if not eliminated entirely, at least in the short term. The third question is this: is the motivation for immigration positive or negative? Does the new immigrant come seeking opportunity, or does he come to America seeking welfare and handouts? Does he or she look for a job or for ways to game the system for benefits, welfare, free medical care, and free education? The E factor is evident early in the immigration process. In Mexico, they sell information kits to prospective illegal immigrants, instructing them on how to get false documents once they get into America. They learn how to use those documents to apply for welfare, unemployment benefits, disability payments, and free services, all of which are to be paid for by taxpayers. Opportunistic politicians encourage and promote illegal immigration by passing laws making it illegal for hospitals or schools to require proof of citizenship before providing services. This ability to escape detection in the use of public services is widely known throughout Latin America and other countries. It creates tremendous incentives for expedient behavior among potentially illegal immigrants. Expedient politicians lobby for bilingual education, even though they know that it has been proved to be completely ineffective. A child forced into bilingual education emerges after a certain time illiterate in both languages, usually Spanish and English. Lack of English literacy slams the door in the face of even the most sincere, aspiring young person. Over time, bilingual education and lowered teaching standards in inner-city schools creates an uneducated, resentful lower class who are blocked from achieving the American dream, but whose votes and support can be manipulated by clever politicians. In most cases, these politicians know exactly what they're doing and what social situation they are creating for the future. After all, they are expedient. They then use demagogic techniques to fan the flames of envy and resentment. They encourage illegal and illiterate immigrants to blame all their problems on tax-paying citizens who complain about being taxed and penalized to provide them with free money, education, and medical services. People who think it is unfair, unjust, and wrong to be forced to provide for illegal immigrants who have broken the law to enter the country are demonized as lacking compassion or being racist. The solution for illegal immigration is to simply enforce the laws against it, to make it expedient not to enter the country illegally by severely punishing anyone who does. There are officially 7 million illegal immigrants in America today. Unofficially, the estimate is as high as 21 million people spread out all over the country. In the absence of political will and the courage to enforce our laws, the U.S. is putting its future as a dynamic country with a common language and heritage at risk. By continually making it attractive for people to come to the United States illegally, we are creating social and political problems that will take generations to solve.
To continue, please insert the next CD.